Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It wasn't too long ago California voters approved a historic investment in arts education. Prop 28 was passed less than a year ago in November by a wide margin with 64% of the vote, meant to establish new ongoing funding for K-12 arts education. A big goal is to make up for decades of funding struggles. But Cap Radio's Sacramento education reporter, Shashi Pabha, found that along with an arts block grant, there are already challenges and limitations in how that money will show up in classrooms. Shashi joins us now with a look at the state of arts education in public schools, how we got here, and what could help. Good morning, Shashi.
Good morning, Vicky.
So what we're talking about is really the first in a series of reporting that you're going to be focusing on when it comes to arts education or lack thereof in public schools. When did this idea first start to take shape?
Well, I don't think it's an unknown fact that we have divested from arts education nationally over the course of like 3 decades. But a 2019 report by Create California found that 89% of public schools in California were actually not meeting the state standards for arts education. At that point, the question becomes, what's happening locally? What's happening in Sacramento? Because that is what I'm interested in. In this county, what are we seeing? And so on average, we know a few things, right? We have a very diverse population, and we know that Black and brown students in socioeconomically disadvantaged regions are disproportionately affected. So I wanted to give the context and the story of where our funding is coming from, because the funding for our schools is contingent on the state's budget. So it did have to start a little bit more statewide to get the local story going. But throughout the story, I do dive into the local element where, you know, we can understand how the state's funding is impacting Sacramento's teachers, arts teachers specifically.
So given that there's a general understanding of the challenges with arts education nationally and also here in Sacramento, as an education reporter, did your reporting just confirm hunches that you already had about these challenges, or were there some other big aha moments, even from your journalistic perspective, as you continue to dig deeper?
That's a really good question, because a lot of times as an education reporter, nothing is an aha moment, but I have to dive into everything as though I actually don't know anything about it to see, like, what are you seeing from the greater perspective? What is that, you know, 3,000 foot view type thing? And a few things kind of did stand out in the process of my investigation. One of the first things was that the California Department of Education has not released arts education data since 2019. And this data collection is part of the federal program of collecting arts data. So why haven't they released it since 2019? It's a question most arts advocates are asking. It's something we want to know, because we're using, you know, delayed data at this point already. The other point I found was that with regards to funding, there's actually no person appointed at the California Department of Education dedicated to arts-related budget allocation or legislation, which means if you pass something like Prop 28, there's no one you can go to at the CDE that will point you in the direction of this is how you can use your funds. It's coming from like a variety of sources, people having to push to find out how can this money actually be used. That's a big point of contention, because if you don't know how to use the money, how are you going to do anything with it? How are you going to set your next fiscal year's budget, you know? And then the last thing I found was, you know, Prop 28 funding, which initially dedicated around $1 billion to arts education in the state, was passed without enough consultation from those actually delivering the services. So many of the administrators that I was talking to, people that are actually in the schools, were underscoring that the staffing shortages and the delineation between teaching artists and arts teachers is going to be a big point of contention again in when you're looking at this funding.
Yeah, what if there are some people who also think that arts education is just an extracurricular activity, especially when compared to STEM fields? Can you explain just the fundamental value arts education plays to the growth of students?
Absolutely. I think, you know, after the divestment away from the arts about 3 decades ago, we started to see this generation that grew up without the arts. And so you can actually track what happened after you took arts away from school systems. Rice University has just one of many studies that talk about the benefits of arts education for youth, including better social and emotional health, improved test scores, and mitigation of truancy in schools. And so these conversations are becoming way more prevalent in the public education space than they were before, specifically after COVID, where we started to see that Black and brown students were not meeting state standards in reading and math, higher than any other demographic. And we started to see lower, you know, we saw a decrease in mental health in students in the county as well. So I think that's another point to think of. Combined with or compounded with the fact that you have a diverse population, what does culturally competent education look like, and what does equitable access look like for arts education here?
And you really got an on-the-ground level. You started off at Robles School District, which is in Sacramento County. So just help us visualize the student body, because one school district to the next can be pretty different.
Right. Robla is a majority Black and brown school district with 84% of its families that are in the lower income bracket, and many are English language learners. One of the drivers of arts education have actually been parents throughout the country. And Robla School District works hard on parent engagement. They have dinners where childcare is provided so that parents can get involved in their child's education. But there are no identified parent-teacher associations in the district. And that is actually a really big point. A lot of times, PTAs are the ones funding arts education in schools, even in Sacramento.
And you started at Glenwood Elementary. What did you learn about the impact that arts education has on these elementary school students?
Well, I went straight to the source. I went to the little first graders who were just like vibrating with energy when I got to speak with them about getting to go to this arts class. And they were able to identify that this is different than their normal space. So I'd like for you to hear from them. The first is 7-year-old Salvador Vasquez.
I'm excited for art class because there's so much fun things to do, and we can color and we can make nice details.
How cute.
Very cute.
And then his classmate, Lisandro Zapeda, tells me he notices the juxtaposition between math and art in class.
It's because it's different. It makes me be happy because coloring is so fun because it's creative. With the projects, we get to bring them in our house. We can show them to our family and it will be cool.
Yeah, you can just see in these two just accounts, like, it adds richness to their young lives and improves overall the school experience and the experience of education and what a classroom can offer. When it comes to the arts education at Glenwood and, for example, these first graders that you spoke to, does this reflect what is offered at schools across Sacramento County?
Actually, no. So Glenwood Elementary, and which is in the Robla School District, is actually ahead of the curve. They provide every student with 40 minutes of arts, visual arts programming a week. They have one visual arts enrichment teacher, Andrea Rodriguez, who runs all the programming for the entire school and sees 450 students a week. So this is more, and I know this for a fact, this is more than most schools in the county. And that's not even meeting the state standards, which requires that you provide a theater, music, and dance curriculum as well. They're just getting visual arts programming.
So if there is a state mandate that arts education has to be offered in K through 12 schools across California, why are some school districts struggling to just implement the requirement?
There's no accountability. So when you have nothing in place to hold systems accountable, there's no way to track what's going on. It's not legally enforced. And so that, along with the incremental loss of funding, has just contributed to a landscape where you see, you know, arts funding is coming from obscure sources. It's very confusing where it's coming from. And the malleability of a budget in a school is entirely dependent on the priorities of the principal. And if there are teacher and parent champions in the school system, in many cases, if you have, you know, a principal or an art teacher leave, you'll see the end of that arts program. We actually see this with Clara Studio, which is a nonprofit in Midtown providing dance programming to Sacramento City Unified Schools. And they have to get the buy-in from the teachers and the principals. And executive director at the nonprofit, Megan Weigant, confides that this can prove to be difficult when you don't have consistent arts programming dedicated to schools.
There's a lot of principal turnover this year at the public school systems. And so, for example, we had a contract to start at a new school or to come back to a school where we'd been. And we walk in on the first day and we're like, you're not the principal we used to work with. the principal, similar to a lot of teachers, was saying, well, I don't know if I want my teachers losing an hour of classroom time every week. And one of our teaching artists teaching, and the principal like poked her head in, and all of a sudden this teaching artist is now tying it to, okay, so, you know, communication, this is how we communicate without words, and being like really clear about the outcomes of the arts learning and saying them loudly so that the principal could hear why, again, having arts in the classroom was valuable.
Mm. So in some cases, you have a lack of consistent arts education coupled with just a lack of funding. So if when it comes to funding, there's a scarcity response. How do school districts really just differ in they got to make difficult financial decisions?
So they're just pulling from different buckets of money is kind of what I started to see. It's a piecemeal approach. If you have a teacher that really cares, you'll try to find the funding, or maybe you'll tell them to work within the budget. But even like the buy-in of, is arts education really something we can take away from classroom time? That's coming from the fact that math and reading are tested and arts is not. So arts can go, but you want students to meet reading and math. And we know for a fact, like I said, through research, that these things can improve test scores. It's opaque, it's inconsistent, and I want to use Andrea Rodriguez at Glenwood Elementary as an example.
You know, my budget eats into my new ideas. So I try to use a lot of what I have and try to be very creative with what I can do here. I wanted to do our favorite like home foods. And so I went to my principal. I was like, hey, I just found this new project. I really want it. Is there money? And he's like, yeah, whatever you need. Just give it to us. We'll get it out of a different budget.
So some districts are just pulling, right? They're pulling from where they can. And then you have districts like San Juan Unified, which are actually using the funding received for COVID relief for arts programming. But those funds expire in the next year. So there's instability again with whether or not that programming will continue to exist.
Yeah, I mean, it's one-time use funding. It's not sustainable. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio Sacramento education reporter Shashree Pabha about arts education and how unprecedented investment from the state still comes with funding limitations. Okay, so that brings me to that big solution that voters passed last November, Prop 28. And it was in addition to an arts block grant. Remind us what these are meant to accomplish.
So Assembly Bill 181, or the Arts Block Grant, was for instructional material, curriculum development, professional development, and COVID aid. Then we passed Prop 28, which was supposed to be for actually creating teaching artists and teachers in schools that can teach this curriculum. The initial budget for the Arts Block Grant was $3.6 billion, and for Prop 28, it was $990 million. But with the new proposed budget by Gavin Newsom, they're actually cutting this. And so the Prop 28 was subject to a $100 million, it was cut, and there was a $1.8 billion deficit from cutting both of those grants that were given. So at this point, you're going to see they're going to try to supplement the Arts Block Grant with the Prop 28 grant, but they're not for the same purposes and they cannot be utilized in the same ways. So the Legislative Analyst's Office has confirmed that these one-time slashes and adds to this proposed budget will actually not cover the deficit of arts funding that have existed. Mm-hmm.
So given that you also found that there are what are meant to be these lucrative initiatives, right, this Arts Block Grant as well as Prop 28, and the goal is so it scales up arts education, and then now it seems to be at least in the interim with the budget shortfall falling short. So how do you explain what you've learned to really a family that's going to be directly impacted by this, but they just don't have the bandwidth or the time to comb through the weeds of details?
Definitely. There are three major pressure points. We have teachers and staff. Do we have the teachers and staff to do this job? Is there any metric to measure arts education? And what is the guidance of where and how it can be used? Jackie White is the assistant superintendent for Sacramento County's Office of Education and has been focusing on arts during her tenure. A former teacher herself, she's hyper aware of the fact that the supply is not meeting the demand in the county's schools and how Prop 28 will exacerbate that.
But the gap with the funding is that, again, there's no infrastructure built. So I don't even know how we're going to get that many teachers. 200 teachers in just Sacramento County. 15,000 for the state. So that's a huge number of teachers. Like, we don't even generate that many teachers, just teachers.
Yeah, that's a big hill to climb. Finally, Srishti, I mean, you listen to students, first graders, you listen to educators, arts advocates in the community. What was the big takeaway that you had when it comes to the role arts education plays in our lives and really what's at stake if we don't have it at an early age?
Definitely, we need it. The loss is being witnessed by our generation and then those younger than us. We've seen more mental health incidences reported. We've seen testing rates have not improved for Black students in Sacramento for 10 years. We need equitable arts education for our diverse population. I also just want to clarify, I had misspoken earlier. There was $3.6 billion for the arts block funding. It got cut to $1.8 billion. So that is what I meant. The cut was to $1.8 billion. Just want to clarify.
Yeah, so it's cut in half.
Yeah, cut in half, exactly.
Srishti, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
It's a lot of numbers and a lot of information, but important. That is CAP Radio Sacramento education reporter Srishti Prabha sharing the beginning of their series of reports looking into the state of arts education in K-12 schools. Up next, the Sacramento Public Library is hosting a chat with a pioneer in gay and lesbian fiction. We'll sit down with the Sacramento-based author. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For nearly 150 years, the Sacramento Public Library has been free to the public, growing from serving 21,000 residents to now more than 1.4 million. Libraries have been an integral part of housing the value of writing, from creativity and imagination to also chronicling society's growth and growing pains. And today comes with its own challenges. The American Library Association, which is the oldest and largest library association in the world, reports that last year there was a record number of demands to censor library books and materials, adding that the vast majority were written by or about the LGBTQ+ community and people of color. The Sacramento Public Library is responding, in a sense, by hosting its latest in-depth speaker series titled Enters the Chat. The next guest is with Anne Bannon, a Sacramento-based author and pioneer in gay and lesbian fiction. You likely know her name from the Bebo Brinker Chronicles. It was first published in the 1950s about women who embraced their sexuality, which in turn earned Bannon the title of Queen of Lesbian Pulp Fiction. So let's give a big welcome to author Anne Bannon. We're also joined by Peter Coyle, the Sacramento Public Library Director and CEO, ahead of Bannon's speaker series, which is this Thursday, June 22nd. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
What a treat. Okay, Anne, I want to start with you. So you have work that spans, like, it's endured like 70 years and counting. So I had a wealth of background when preparing for our conversation. But let's just start from square one. Who was Anne before the Bebo Brinker Chronicles? Who was the person that ultimately led you to write?
Who was she? Oh, my goodness. Well, I was a wife and mother. I was a very proper young woman from a nice family. But I was fascinated by the gay community, which, you know, I guess it's really confusing to call it a community from that time, because they were so scattered and so scared. But I wanted to tell a story, and I had seen an interesting connection made in my college sorority. And that kind of inspired me to give it a try. And I'd also read a book by a woman who subsequently became very famous as a writer, not so much of gay love stories. She wrote one in the early part of her career, but she moved on to other kinds of writing, including for young people. But her first novel was a college romance, and you start with what you know. I hadn't been in the romance, but my roommate had. So I thought, well, if she can do it, I can do it. I know I can write, and I wanted to tell stories. And as soon as I got married and had a little free time before the children came into the world, I would sit at the dining room table and work on my husband's portable typewriter. That old Remington was the machine on which I produced the first book, which was called Odd Girl Out. And it did stunningly well. I had no business to be a successful author, but I suddenly was. However, I hid behind my pen name, and I think all of us did. There were only about a dozen of us young women who were writing these books and who didn't realize it, but we had founded a kind of genre, lesbian pulp novels. And to this day, people recognize that phrase. I think we would have been grateful to lose the term pulp, but that became part of it. Because the books earned that title only because they were made of such cheap paper. But the term pulp spread out and encompassed a lot of other meanings, including sexy and ultimately sleazy, in part because of the pulp paper. And in part because of the scandalous cover art. Everybody loved that cover art, except the women for whom the books were intended. But the books were beloved of gay men and straight men. I don't think there were any men that weren't interested in this. I think that, you know, there certainly were gay pulps about the guys. It wasn't just women, but it was, I would say they had a harder time finding success because it's a more fraught kind of love affair than between two women. I mean, you can picture back in ancient Greece, when you entered Athens, there would be signs telling men where to find two lovely ladies having fun together in bed, and you could go watch that for a small fee. And there were signs that were similar carved on the walls of caves in the Scandinavian countries. So this is an ongoing interest. And the editors of these books knew that if they brought in a big male audience, they would make money. They knew the women would find the books anyway, and despite the covers, and they did. But the men were the bulk audience. They were the largest number of people interested in reading about this. And the books, of course, were marketed like magazines. They expected that people would read them on the train on the way to work or the bus, or under the covers when they got home, and then just throw them away. So,
but they didn't. I mean, at the end of the day, your work is taught in colleges. To this very day, you continue to speak publicly, which is why you're here joining us this week. What does it mean to you that your writing, your creativity has just transcended decades and generations?
Well, it's a little bit amazing, and I'm grateful for the interest. On the one hand, and on the other hand, I'm stunned. I thought mine would be thrown away like everybody else's, but you can find them on used books outlets online for hundreds and in some cases thousands of dollars. There was a play based on my books off-Broadway a few years ago that has traveled around the country and to a lot of college campuses. That gave it a big boost as well. And the books are now old and very fragile. As you can imagine, pulp paper doesn't last very well. But I'm grateful, and I'm in a wonderful company. Ray Bradbury, Gore Vidal, Patricia Highsmith, Lawrence Block, a great many very fine writers wrote for the pulps because you could make an awful lot of money that way. And that was how I got my husband to sit down and shut up. He had a check he could take to the bank. He would not read them, but they added significantly to the income of our little family at that point. But nobody knew who I was except my immediate family. So I'm grateful. It's remarkable. I mean, they should have all been thrown away. And now here they are, alive and well, and still being purchased, although mostly, I think, as spoken books. But that's fine. I'm glad people are interested. I think we provided a sort of launch pad, in a way, for what was only a nascent community or a dream among young people in the years right after World War II. It took a while for people to relax and accept the community. But in the meantime, where could you find information about young gay people and what they were wearing and saying to one another and how they were living? So it was important and interesting and had a social significance and cultural significance that I don't think was there prior to that time. So in a way, it had a significance that we ourselves didn't understand, but has then made it important and interesting to young people today who study what sort of trouble we were getting into.
Well, I mean, Annie, you set this up beautifully because, Peter, I was going to ask you, why Anne Bannon? But now we understand why you're going to be having Anne for the Enter the Chat series. Talk to us about this series, because it is an in-depth speaker series.
Yeah, this series is about bringing maybe lesser well-known but also very prolific people in their field to talk about different subjects that need to be part of the conversation. We've had some really remarkable guests. We're really honored to have Anne this Thursday. You know, her work has been rediscovered, and I think it's important for us to continue to have those conversations because I think Anne is being a little modest. She's a trailblazer in this field and did a lot of work for a lot of the books that we have today. A lot of the subjects that, you know, we couldn't read years ago, we can read about now. And those communities have a voice. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have this series, is to make sure that people have those voices and those voices aren't silenced.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento-based author Anne Bannon, a pioneer in gay and lesbian fiction, ahead of her speaker series with the Sacramento Public Library this Thursday. We're also joined by Peter Coyle, who heads the Sacramento Public Library. At the core of this writing is really having people be seen, right, when they felt like they had to be, and justifiably so, in hiding, right? And so they feel that they can resonate, and then they can identify with the characters in this book. And this really comes at an unprecedented time for libraries across the country. As I led with, the American Library Association is reporting that there's a record number of demands to censor library books and materials last year. I think it was nearly double the number from 2021. Are we seeing that here in Sacramento, Peter?
Yeah, here at the Sacramento Public Library, we have not, fortunately, seen a lot of challenges. I think we have a community here which is perhaps a little more open and understanding. We have a rather cosmopolitan clientele, being in the capital city of this major economy. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't affect California. You know, there have been protests at other libraries and banning, not necessarily bannings, but challenges throughout the state. That's happening in school systems as well. So I'm not here in Sacramento, but the state is experiencing it.
And you have more than 20 years of experience working in libraries across the country. How has that deepened your understanding about the time that we're in right now?
I think it really has highlighted the two sides of this issue that really affect America. There's an A side and a B side, and there's very little middle ground. And I think that's the issue, is that it's all or nothing. And it is unprecedented. You know, I've only been involved in one or two challenges in my entire career, but I have friends who have had two and three in 1 year, which is unheard of. And right now, the issue at hand is making sure, like you said, that people can have representation, that they can see themselves in the books that they come to the library. And when people want to take that mirror away from people, that's harmful, that's chilling. And that's what's happened in other countries. And that's the start to totalitarianism and oppression. And that's not what America's about. America's about letting people have freedom and making their own choice.
And what strikes you about the time that we're in now and this call, you know, across the country to censor books and materials? Does it remind you of a prior decade of discomfort or intolerance?
Indeed, it does. And I find it very distressing. And, it's dismaying to think that we might have to go through that all over again. I really hope we've come too far. We've learned too much. We have the bulk of the public with us, I do believe. There are pockets of prejudice around the country, but and in certain communities. But we had some help, actually, when the television programs began to be able to address this subject in a friendly way, instead of presenting gay people as mentally unstable and prone to violence and kind of living desperate lives. That wasn't true. And there were some people, perhaps, in that position, but most people, gay or straight, are just people. And they ought to be allowed to be who they are. And I've always believed that, and I think we were pretty well headed that way, but it's mainly the extremely conservative people who want to preserve the old verities and the old ways of doing things and keep their prejudices intact and inviolable. And it's a shame, and I don't think they are on the right side of history. I don't think that position will prevail. I just hope we get through it quickly, because it leads to a lot of damage, especially to young people who have nowhere else to turn for information or support and think they are still the only ones. I don't think there can be too many kids with a television set in the house who still think that, but there are some who are kind of isolated and whose parents don't allow TV, and it becomes very frightening. I think our books, the old lesbian pulps, actually gave young people an insight to the fact that they were one of many and that it was okay and that you could find somebody to share your life with and get on with things as everyone else did, rather than to be an oddity or something to be lamented and stared at. So when television joined us, that's when the old pulps died, but it did help by bringing the message to so many more people that these are charming, talented, competent human beings. So if we did that, we did something very worthwhile.
I'm curious, and I think it's a good way to end. I mean, Peter, if there's someone who is uncomfortable with this type of literature, maybe sympathetic to some book censorship, what would you like them to know?
I would like them to know that the library is for everybody, and you don't have to check out a book. You can make that choice to not read that book. You can make that choice for your own children, but you don't need to, or can't, you should not make that for everyone. And that's the point, that's really the point of the conversation is parents have the choice. This is not about taking away parents' choice or individual choice. This is about letting everyone have that choice and not putting your belief system or your thoughts and restricting everyone's ability to do that.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, you have been on the receiving end of it. I mean, you had to have an alias, you know, Ann Bannon. What would you like someone to know who may be uncomfortable?
About me?
Or about the literature?
Oh, I would like them to know that it saved lives, that there were many young women. One in particular told me her story about walking up to the bridge in her hometown with the idea of throwing herself over and drowning and giving up her life at that moment because she had begun to realize she was lesbian. And for on some whim, she stopped on the way and walked into the drugstore, sort of aimlessly wondering if anything could ever change her mind. And those were the days when the pulps were displayed on drugstore kiosks and shelves. She spotted Odd Girl Out. So she thought, what could that be? The cover illustration grabbed her, and she bought the book, and she went out and strolled over to the bridge, and she sat down on a bench, and she just consumed the book in about an hour. And she said, I got home, I got up, and I walked home and had dinner, and I lived. I knew I wasn't alone. I knew I was okay. It was the beginning of my life as both a full human being and ultimately a writer myself. So it was a wonderful story, and I think it spoke for many young people.
And that is a powerful way to end. Thank you so much, Anne and Peter.
Thanks for having us.
Ann Bannon is a Sacramento-based author and pioneer in gay and lesbian fiction, joined by Peter Coyle, the Sacramento Public Library director and CEO. You can listen and see Ann in action. There is an in-depth speaker series, Enters the Chat, where Bannon will be speaking this Thursday, June 22nd. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Preserving a writing system that's been around for 2,000 years, that is the goal of our next guest's work. Anthropologist and epigrapher Dr. Michael Grove is the president of Mayas for Ancient Mayan, MAM, and chair of the anthropology department at Sacramento City College. He and a group of his colleagues from around the world are working to preserve the learning, reading, and writing of classic Maya hieroglyphic script. The ancient Maya script has been around for thousands of years, but has largely been forgotten or simply lost in the last 500 years as the Maya people were forced to abandon their unique writing system after nonstop colonization. While there are still dozens of Mayan languages still spoken, roughly 30, I think, they have been cut off from reading and understanding their written history. The work now is to reconnect Maya people with their history and sciences. This evening, Dr. Grof is giving a lecture at the Mexican Consulate here in Sacramento, and it is titled A Tree Regains Its Roots, Revitalization of the Maya Hieroglyphic Script. Good morning, Dr. Grof.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
I think that's the first time I've said epigrapher.
Most people don't know that word. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So give us a little window into your really unique and fascinating world. How did you first get interested in Maya people and really the ancient writing system?
Well, my dad was always interested in archaeology, Maya archaeology. He went hitchhiking down there when he was 20, way back in the early 1950s. And he always had stories about it. But I went on to study marine biology. But I wanted to save the world from humans. But as I studied biology, I then became really interested in cultural anthropology and realized that it was through cultural anthropology, through our culture, that really is the issue, and changing people's understanding of culture and learning from other cultures that live more in harmony with the natural world was something that really interested me. And I became really fascinated by cultural anthropology, went on to do a master's degree at the California Institute of Integral Studies. While I was there, I was a chocolate maker. And so I just handed you a box of one of my chocolates. And as I was a chocolate maker, I then realized, why am I a chocolate maker? But I was more of an anthropologist, a frustrated teacher. And so I decided to explore the history of chocolate and did my master's thesis on the history of chocolate. And it led me to the ancient Maya, which I had always been interested in from the edges. And I decided to make a really nice chocolate box that was going to teach people about where chocolate comes from and how the Maya domesticated it. And so I chose randomly the Maya Hob calendar, which is a 365-day calendar with 19 different glyphs. And I thought it made a nice chocolate box. So I took a year to sculpt all of these different glyphs, some of those that you see right there. And as I'm doing that, I really got familiar with the little nooks and crannies and all the different aspects of this beautiful writing system. And I thought I would put into the box what these glyphs meant and realize that no one had actually fully deciphered this particular series of glyphs. And I became absolutely obsessed with trying to figure that out. And that led me to studying ancient Maya writing and astronomy at UC Davis in the Native American Studies Department, where I then graduated in 2007 and was very interested in working together with indigenous peoples, especially the ancient Maya or the living Maya, of which, there are 30 different languages still spoken. And because the writing system really had been lost because of colonization, as you mentioned, there is a strong interest among many Maya people about reconnecting with their past. And so here, this very esoteric thing that I ended up studying happened to be incredibly meaningful for a lot of people. And I was recruited to become the president of the organization Mayas for Ancient Mayan, or Maya Antigua para los Mayas, or MAM. And the name MAM is actually, as an acronym, means ancestor or grandfather. It's a reciprocal kin term, actually. It's what grandchildren call their grandparents, too. So it has that meaning as well. So that is how I got interested in it. So
there are still millions of Maya that are still around today. I mean, they're living in countries like Mexico, Guatemala, Belize.
And here.
In the United States, Honduras, El Salvador. What is life like for them today? What do you learn from them when you meet and talk with them?
Oh, well, yes, some of the people that I work with right now, they grow up in education systems. I mean, many grow up in traditional households. Often their parents are teaching them Mayan languages, so many of these Mayan languages are thriving. Some of them are not. Some of them are what we call moribund, or where only the older generation is speaking them. But typically, they're coming from relatively low-income households that have less access to education, less access to healthcare, less access to a lot of things that we take for granted here. And so in their school systems, they don't typically learn much about Maya history and this incredible rich past that they have. And so they're very interested, especially since the dawn of the decipherment of Maya writing, which has really only happened since the 1950s and really, really after that, only the 1980s and 90s. they became extremely interested in learning about this. And it's so incredibly meaningful for them to help them keep their languages and cultures alive. And they're very proud of their cultures. And they retained an enormous amount, even though they were forced to abandon the writing system many, 500 some years ago. They still have retained a lot of their cultures by blending it together with Catholicism, for example.
Given that Maya's for ancient Mayan, I mean, your work also includes preserving the hieroglyphic script. For someone who isn't familiar with what that is, what is a hieroglyphic script?
Well, if you think about ancient Egyptian writing and so how, especially the very calligraphic versions, it looks like images of things. Maya hieroglyphic writing is very similar to that, although the graphic content, I would say, is even more elaborate. And the way that artists or scribes called atzib, which also means painter as well as scribe or writer, so writing and painting were seen as one and the same. The writing system really it has very rounded edges, and they would combine together different images, often of faces or profiles of people and animals, of different body parts, of things in the natural world. And some of these came to represent phonetic syllables, whereas others are logographic, meaning very much like Chinese writing, where you have an image that represents a whole word. So it's kind of like Japanese writing in that it combines together a logographic script where symbols represent whole words, together with a syllabic writing system where you have syllables represented as well.
We're just getting a little taste this morning of your knowledge and your breadth of knowledge when it comes to Maya culture, because you're going to be giving a lecture this evening at the Mexican consulate. What do you hope people learn when they attend and take it all in?
Well, I want to thank Ambassador Liliana Ferrer, who invited me to present this evening. And there, I think, are about 80 people attending tonight, and I'll be giving a visual rundown of the work that I do, a little bit of the history of the decipherment of writing and the situation going on with language extinction and language death and language change, and how many Maya people are very interested in preserving those languages. So I really hope that people walk away with a deeper understanding of the importance of preserving languages and cultures and worldviews that may not be the dominant worldview, the Western worldview. And so there's so much to offer as far as the history of sciences, the history of art, the history of writing and different cultures that the Maya have to offer. And so I want people to understand the diversity also, that there are 30 different Mayan languages still around, whereas many people think the Maya people disappeared and mysteriously vanished, or, those types of things that you often hear about in popular culture. But the Maya people are very much here. They're very much interested in preserving their languages and cultures and their literature especially. And preserving their writing system is one really important way they can do that.
We're talking about deep-rooted issues that span centuries, millennia. Why do you think now is the right time for this appetite to preserve and restore potentially lost languages of the Maya people?
Yeah, well, I think now, especially since the decipherment of Maya writing has happened outside of Maya cultures, it's been people like myself who are not Maya, who have had access to a lot of resources, a lot of the published sources that are often in English or not in Spanish and non-Mayan language especially. So Maya people are really interested in gaining access to that, and that's really what my organization is helping to do and helping to fund Maya teachers who are now becoming experts in the reading and writing of the decipherment and using the writing system to write their own specific current Mayan languages. And I think it's a really important moment as well for the rights for indigenous peoples who have maintained knowledge about the natural world, and especially given our issues right now with the environment, with water, with climate change, and so on. There's a lot of wisdom in, for example, the Maya creation story, the K'iche Maya creation story called the Popol Vuh, which is shared by many Maya people and goes back all the way to some 600 BC or so, when we see the first evidence of that in a site called Isapa.
Finally, in the last 30 seconds to a minute we have, you also go on a field trip of sorts. It's called Congreso, and it's held in Chiapas, and it's going to be next month. And that's the southern Mexico border, which borders Guatemala. Just briefly talk to us about what you gain from traveling to Chiapas, you know, in the spirit of MOM?
Sure. Well, MOM actually sponsors, usually every other year we sponsor the Congreso, which is an international congress of Maya people. And there'll be 120 different Maya people from multiple different countries speaking many different languages, with the lingua franca being Spanish. And I'm being asked to come down to help coordinate this and also teach with some of my colleagues, along with some other Maya professors. But we are raising funds for this right now, and so it's a really wonderful experience. It hasn't happened in the past 5 years because of the pandemic, but this will be the fifth International Congreso on Ancient Maya Writing, or Oher Maya Tzib, as it's known. And so this is a really important time when we're still raising funds, and if you are interested in helping out with that, please visit our website, which is at Discover MOM, or Discover with the M-A-M afterwards. And there's a support page where you can help, actually. And our PayPal page is actually the best way to do that right now.
And we have a link on our Insight page as well.
Excellent.
To make it easy. Thank you so much for the chocolate. It is beautiful.
You're so very welcome.
It's too beautiful to eat, but I'm sure I know it tastes really good.
Mahun uban, as they say in Kakchikel Maya.
Thank you so much, Dr. Grof.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Grof is the president of Mayas for Ancient Mayan, or MOM, and chair of the anthropology department at Sacramento City College. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.